The IER podcast is produced by Creative Kin and sponsored by Thompson Solicitors. Thanks for listening.
If you've got workers who don't even know which systems are being used to make decisions about them, or how those decisions are being made by the systems because they're operating within what's often described as the black box of the system, you can't get that technology in front of a tribunal and ask, why did you make this decision? What were you trying to do?
Having a proactive duty on employers to keep their workplace free of sexual harassment is in principle a very good step forward. The way in which it's formulated is that the employer must take all reasonable steps to prevent sexual harassment. And the key issue is, what are all those reasonable steps?
Welcome to the sixth episode of the Institute of Employment Rights podcast. Thanks to Thompson Solicitors for sponsoring the podcast. Please visit thompsonswithap.law/employment-bill to find out more from their team of employment law experts on the government's employment rights bill. In this sixth episode, experts Professor Sandy Fredman, Professor of Law at the University of Oxford and Director of Oxford Human Rights Hub, and also Dr. Joe Atkinson, Lecturer in Employment Law at the University of Southampton and Director of the Stephan Cross Centre for Women, Equality and the Law. They will discuss their analysis of the Labour Party's changes to equality legislation. This will include the impact for workers on the Employment Rights Bill, the Equality, Race and Disability Bill, and other elements of law currently on the statute book, but not yet enacted, like the socio-economic duty. So, folks, there are a few interesting bits on the Employment Rights Bill, and especially so on equality for workers. First, how do we anticipate things like third-party harassment and the provisions for that will help workers?
Sexual harassment has been unlawful discrimination for some decades now, but it's still, unfortunately, extremely prevalent in workplaces. And a surprisingly high number of women still report women in their workforce are subject to sexual harassment, or they've witnessed it in their workforce, or they have themselves been subjected to it. And very recently, we've seen Al Fayed and the horrendous stories about his sexual harassment of workers at Harrods. We've had this protection against discrimination, but very few women are able to come forward and complain. And we have very few complaints to tribunals. So it really is time for a reset to try and think about this again. What we have in the current package are three new strands. One of them, which has just come into effect on the 24th of October, is a proactive duty on employers to prevent sexual harassment happening at the workplace. The second one is that employers are now going to be liable for third-party harassment of their workers. And the third is that whistleblowing about sexual harassment is now protected. The proactive duty is potentially one of the most interesting because it takes the burden off women to have to bring an individual complaint. And we know how difficult that is, how exposing it is, how hard it is for women to actually substantiate these kind of claims. Having a proactive duty on employers to keep their workplace free of sexual harassment is in principle a very good step forward. The way in which it's formulated is that the employer must take all reasonable steps to prevent sexual harassment. And the key issue is, what are all those reasonable steps? What the government is saying is that we need a change in workplace culture. We need now, just like we have health and safety at work, we need it to be an expectation that a workplace can be free of sexual harassment. But what those reasonable steps are, well, they do risk being quite procedural. And a lot of it really depends on whether employers are prepared to really internalize this duty to prevent sexual harassment. And again, there's space for unions to hold employers to account, and space for workers to do the same. At the moment, the remedy is quite interesting too, because instead of requiring the complainant to go to a tribunal to prove a breach of this duty, you can complain to the Equality and Human Rights Commission, even if an act of sexual harassment has not happened. You don't have to have that big hurdle of proving that the act has happened. but that the employer has not taken all reasonable steps. And then it's up to the Equality and Human Rights Commission to pursue it. And they do have an array of powers to do it. The real problem is they don't have the resources. And we know already that they are very limited in their ability to do any kind of enforcement. The second provision is that the employer now has a duty to prevent sexual harassment by third parties of employees in the course of their employment. And that's also been a big gap because clients, contractors, customers, other people who interact with the workers might harass workers. And the third part is the whistleblowing provision, which is that if a worker reasonably believes that it's in the public interest to make a disclosure that sexual harassment has happened, then they are protected from being victimized. So what will be interesting to see is if it has any impact on non-disclosure agreements, which we know are very rife. And that is the reason why the Harrods claim and others, so many complaints of sexual harassment are buried, settled, pushed out the way. So it will be interesting to see, and I see that many solicitors advising employers already saying we need to think about how we formulate these non-disclosure agreements, but only when the disclosure might be in the public interest.
Joe, have you got anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I think picking up on a couple of those points, the Employment Rights Bill strengthens that existing duty that was just come into force from employers needing to take reasonable steps to now needing to take all reasonable steps. So the Equality and Human Rights Commission had recently given guidance about what those reasonable steps look like. So it's things like having a policy in place, ongoing training, reporting frameworks. And so what precisely reasonable steps look like will vary depending on the size of the business, etc. But it's now, hopefully, by strengthening it, it's not just, okay, an optional pick and mix. There's now you have to do all of these things as appropriate to the size of your business. And then the second point is about the enforcement, and absolutely agree with the point about the lack of resourcing that's there. So the Equality, Race and Disability Bill has a commitment to create a new enforcement unit, and whether that helps solve some of these resourcing issues as part of the Fair Work Agency or not, it'll be interesting to see that. And then on the whistleblowing and whether that's going to be in the public interest, I would argue that almost always disclosures of sexual harassment, misconduct are going to be in the public interest. It might be that some clarification of that in the legislation would be helpful as well.
Just that alone, I think, would be incredibly useful. I was at Unison conference this year, and we were talking about a myriad of things, and one of them was sexual harassment. And some of the examples some of these women were coming out with, I mean, these were big NHS trusts and local authority schools. It was happening in, like, in the staff room or something like that, where people were being propositioned, really dark stuff. So just having the ability to speak out about it, I know some of the devil will be in the detail of that, but I'm sure it could make, theoretically, it could make a big difference to people suffering from sexual harassment. Now, there's a section on employers having to undertake equality action plans. How do we think this might be useful to workers and their trade unions, for instance, in pay bargaining, recruitment exercises or restructuring?
So this is in the context largely of gender pay gap reporting. So although we've had a right to equal pay for work of equal value since 1970, more recently, in about 2017, there was a provision requiring employers of over 250 employees to annually report on the gender pay gap, which is not just unequal pay for work of equal value, but the pay gap across the whole of the workforce. The problem with that is that these did not come with any requirement of follow-up. So the background principle is a kind of name and shame. If it is transparent and you have a very big gender pay gap in your workforce, the assumption was that the employer might take the initiative to fix that. Since then, it's become apparent that although employers do report their gender pay gap, the worst employers remain the worst. And if you're at the bottom of the league table, you remain there. So obviously, the naming and shaming doesn't really matter to those employers. The proposition now is, once it becomes clear that there is a gender pay gap, to actually require employers to develop an equality action plan. Actually, the bill that's before Parliament doesn't say very much about this at all. It just gives the power to the government to make regulations, to require employers to develop and publish a plan, showing the steps that they were going to take. So at the moment, we don't know what those would look like. But what we do know, what the analogy could be, is that the European Union has just adopted what's called a pay transparency directive, which includes within it a duty to publish and implement an equality action plan under certain conditions if there is a gender pay gap in your workforce.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think it would make sense to try and align with the EU directive as a kind of baseline in this area, and also to try and introduce some kind of worker engagement or worker involvement or trade union involvement in developing those action plans so that there's voice in terms of the people who are on the receiving end of those inequalities being able to help design the appropriate solutions for the workplace.
Design it and also police it, because I guess if the employer has an action plan, the trade union would be holding them to account on it. What have you, if it's been a year on, what have you done since then? So it would be very useful as a cumulative thing to keep a check on employers, I suppose, locally as well. I believe there's something on outsourced workers where employers can't use outsourcing to avoid reporting on various pay gaps. What do we think about those proposals?
So this was something else which was in the Labour Party manifesto. Because of the very real problem of more and more outsourcing, more and more fragmentation of the workforce, which makes it very difficult to pursue an equal pay claim. So as we might know, if you want to bring a claim for equal pay for work of equal value, your comparator has to be employed by the same employer at the same or equivalent establishment. So one way of sidestepping that is for the employer to outsource certain parts of the workforce, whether they do it deliberately or not. But it has become more and more usual for, say, cleaning workers who are largely feminized, can often be both feminized and racialized, to be contracted out and yet be working at the same establishment and doing work of potentially equal value to, say, white male maintenance workers, but they cannot use the in-house workers as comparators. So that is the problem with outsourced workers. And the difficulty now is to find a way of including those in the comparison. But the government hasn't yet gone that far. They've only brought in a proposition to bring outsourced workers into the gender pay gap reporting, which we talked about already, by saying that the information about these outsourced workers must be included in the gender pay gap reporting. It's quite a limited provision. So I think there's a lot to be done on outsourcing. It's a really important topic, but so far only a very small input has been made in the Employment Rights Bill.
And particularly because those gender reporting requirements are only on the larger companies, so over 250, which might be the ones that are most likely to outsource. But once you combine that small sector of the economy that you're subjecting to reporting, and then you limit it to one step in the value chain, then you might end up with quite an unrepresentative picture of the problem. And then there's also the problem that Sandy mentioned, that the companies who are at the bottom of these league tables seem to take the reputational hit and not do much to actually change their practices.
Yeah. So there's something in there about changes to paternity leave as well, isn't there, I believe?
As someone on there who's recently made use of those, I'll step in on that one first. And so the main change is that it's moving from a right with a qualifying period to what the Labour Party calls a day one right. So you don't have to be in employment for any degree of time. So this is important if you're thinking about changing job and you're going to be taking this leave. But if you move job, you're going to have to work there for 26 weeks before you get the entitlement. Then that restricts that. And so like they're doing with unfair dismissal and some sick pay rights, they're rightly moving to a system where it's immediate entitlements. The bigger picture on parental leave and family-friendly policies is that we're lagging behind a lot of other systems that have struck a better balance between caring, flexibility and working responsibilities. And particularly if you look at the shared parental leave system we have here, very few people are able to make use of it, because you end up usually taking effectively unpaid leave. And so very few families are actually able to make use of that. And there is a commitment by Labour to a broader review of these family flexible policies. I'm hopeful that we'll be looking to the Scandinavian models to think about maybe compulsory leave for a period of time, or at least extending towards 4 weeks of 2 weeks is so little time. And by having the disparity between paternity leave and maternity leave, it just perpetuates stereotypical caring roles.
Right, yeah, we did an event on equality more generally, but we had someone from TUC come to speak about that, and they were looking at it when it was brought in and how it was panning out, and they found that, yeah, it didn't have that much impact because generally speaking, the lowest earner tended to take the leave, and generally speaking, that tended to be the woman. So it wasn't really working essentially because of existing pay inequalities already. Okay, well, I feel like we should move on because we wanted to try and touch on the Equality, Race and Disability Bill. Now, we haven't seen a copy of this yet, but there's plenty of commentary out there about what we might expect from it. Like at the moment, theoretically, workers can already bring equal pay claims under the Equality Act, but it's thought that this new law will bring in greater legal certainty for claimants. Do you think that's the case, and how might this law express itself in the already backlogged tribunal system?
Yeah. Well, as you said, we haven't seen the text, so we're sort of in the dark somewhat. But yeah, the declared intention is to legislate to create an equal pay claim specific framework for the protected characteristics of race and disability. I'm not fully sure how that's going to work. I'd say there is already protection against pay discrimination on grounds of race and disability. If someone is being paid less because of those characteristics, then they can bring a claim. It's just under a direct discrimination claim under the Equality Act rather than an equality of terms claim. And so I think it is perfectly possible to kind of align the race and disability characteristics with the current framework that we have for sex discrimination in pay. I'm not sure what the advantage would be of that in terms of the time it will take, the complexity of the legislation that will be involved, other than perhaps you get a strategic messaging that you now have in legislation a right to equal pay for equal work explicitly based on those characteristics, whereas before you had to sort of interpret it. It was a direct discrimination claim rather than an equal pay claim. So I think that would be the kind of political messaging and advantage. Yeah, I'd be interested to hear Sandy's view on whether there are any legal advantages to that change.
Yes, I think it's been quite surprising how often the messaging from the government has been that there is no right to equal pay on grounds of race or disability, whereas in fact there is. It's always been possible to bring a discrimination claim on the basis of race and disability. The reason why we have separate provisions for gender pay discrimination is historic, in that the first piece of legislation in the discrimination field was the Equal Pay Act in 1970. So when the Sex Discrimination Act came in, they divided up the jurisdiction so that there's a provision now in the Equality Act 2010, previously in the Sex Discrimination Act, which said that contractual pay claims go down the one route, which is the equal pay route, and non-contractual discrimination goes down the other route. But that division was never put in for race or disability. And actually, probably there's some advantages to doing it as a direct discrimination claim, largely because if you're bringing a direct discrimination claim, you need to show that you've been less favorably treated than a person of the opposite protected characteristic would be treated. So you don't need an actual comparator. You could have what's called a hypothetical comparator. And yet, if you're bringing a pay claim on grounds of sex or gender, you have to find an actual male who's employed in the same establishment. And that's been a huge drawback for equal pay claims. I think what's more interesting and more important is why there has been so little awareness and so little use of the discrimination provisions for pay on grounds of ethnicity or disability. And that really relates to how very difficult it is to bring a discrimination claim in any context. And race discrimination claims are across the board very low before tribunals. And that's because it's so difficult, so slow, it's expensive. And in the end, the compensation that you get might really not be worth your while.
The possible counterpoint might be to say that although you can use a hypothetical comparator in direct discrimination claims, that involves the tribunal guessing or trying to interpret how they think the employer would have treated this hypothetical other person. And sometimes tribunals can be cautious or reluctant to do that. Whereas if they're faced with two people with contracts and they're asked, are they doing similar work or are they doing work of equal value? That might be a question that they find easier to answer in the affirmative rather than this hypothetical situation. So I agree that this seems like replicating a historically arbitrary division between contractual and non-contractual claims for other characteristics. I'm yet to see a kind of convincing legal argument for what the benefits of that would be.
Now, we've discussed the gender pay gap report before and some of the problems with that. Now, I believe one of the parts of this proposed bill is that for businesses with more than 250 staff, there'll be mandatory ethnicity and disability pay gap reporting. So bearing in mind the problems we discussed before, how do we think that this might manifest and help? But also secondly, how might we see employers try to circumvent this? I'm thinking particularly about things like the old Woolworths case with redundancy. They broke up bargaining units to say that they didn't have to follow various elements of redundancy law. I'm just wondering what workarounds employers might try and find on that.
I think these are sensible and important provisions. You know, there are significant disability and race pay gaps, and they're sometimes not understood or get less attention. So I think introducing a kind of parity of reporting is good. As you said, the problems with the gender pay reporting framework will also be imported across to this. So in terms of data accuracy or whether it's treated as a box-ticking exercise, I think one way that we could try and forestall that would be also importing these new action plans that we're seeing in the Employment Rights Bill for the gender pay gap. If you are creating a reporting framework for race and disability pay gaps, then it would also make sense to tack on those action plans for those gaps as well. I haven't seen whether that's going to be included or not, but you'd hope it would be.
Anything to add to that, Sandy?
Yes, I agree that it's really important to include the reporting on ethnicity and disability, particularly because when it comes to pay gap, the intersectionality is very striking. So what this might enable us to be able to see is the extent to which the lowest paid workers are both female and racialized, or potentially migrant workers, potentially disabled female black workers. We might be able to see how those intersectional issues work through. So I think that is very important. But still to add that, as we said before, 250 is a very high number. It's also likely that there will be wrangles over what exactly the 250 covers, as you said. You could outsource some of your workers and then fall below the 250. And even though there would now be a requirement to report on those outsourced workers, once you're under 250, you're out of it altogether. Equally important, we are still in a very binary notion of who is an employee and who is not. And it's very easy for employers to characterize the relationship with their workers as independent contractors, which would also potentially fall below this 250 threshold. We know that platform work is becoming a greater and greater part of the workforce, and many workers who potentially should be regarded as employees are characterized as independent contractors, and this might be an incentive to do this even more. So I think really it would be helpful if the government rethought the threshold. There's no real reason why there should be a gender pay gap permissible in a smaller employment just because it's smaller, rather than a larger employer just because it's larger.
Okay, so I thought we'd touch on AI and equality in the workplace. And now, Joe, you and Professor Philippa Collins of the University of Bristol co-wrote the publication for the IAR on algorithmic management and a new generation of rights at work. This effectively detailed how the use of algorithms being used more widely in the world of work are breaking UK employment laws, and it makes the case for regulating AI at work. Now, given what we've just spoken about, with the government seemingly wanting to boost equality at work, what are the tensions between equality and AI, and how might the government go about fixing those problems so that technology is compliant with UK laws?
Yeah, I think this is a really important issue, and I think it's one that currently seems to be a bit of a gap in the government's plans. So there's a lot in the Employment Rights Bill, there's a lot coming up, so I think there's a danger of us not future-proofing equality law to the extent that we should be doing. So as Sandy mentioned, there's been a rise of platform work. So that's where workers are being managed or directed through platforms, who they're working for, the tasks that they do, etc. But even in conventional workplaces, more and more technology is being used to recruit people, allocate their work, evaluate their work, and even make disciplinary or dismissal decisions. So when you have algorithmic systems making those sorts of decisions, it introduces a risk of discrimination, but rather than by human managers, by the outputs of those systems being biased. So whether that's caused by reflecting historical bias or discrimination that's in the training data, which is then replicated by the system. So if you've got a system that decides who gets promoted and you're training it on a data set that's full of people who have been promoted historically who are white men, then it's going to be more likely to predict or recommend that white male workers should be promoted. There's various other ways that discrimination can work its way through these systems. But the point is that we need to be thinking about what changes, if any, need to be made to our equality law frameworks to make sure they cover these types of decision, and also that equality law can be enforced effectively in this context. So one of the main problems is that if you've got workers who don't even know which systems are being used to make decisions about them, or how those decisions are being made by the systems, because they're operating within what's often described as the black box of the system, you can't get that technology in front of a tribunal and ask, why did you make this decision? What were you trying to do? That's why in the report we wrote with the Institute for Employment Rights, we said there needs to be these transparency obligations so that workers and trade unions know how these systems are working, what they're being used for. And there should be assessments before they're put in place about their potential equality impacts, as well as impacts on other rights. And so I think this is something that the government should try and include in their future planning in the equality law space. And whether that's, you know, launching a review, more consultation, but just making sure it doesn't fall through the gaps in everything else that is going on.
Interesting. So how does regulating AI in other countries work? Are there more effective strategies out there for prohibiting and regulating AI and algorithms? And how do we stop employers from saying, oh, it's not us, it's the developers in Silicon Valley, and, you know, exonerating themselves from any kind of blame?
This is a really fast moving area. So there is a lot going on, and each jurisdiction is working out how to do it. The EU has, as Sandy mentioned earlier, the Platform Work Directive, which is the kind of leading at the moment example of these sorts of rights, where there are information rights, there are rights to review decisions that are being made by technology. In the EU, those are only applicable to platform workers, whereas, as I said, these systems are being used in all workplaces. I think we should undoubtedly try and align with those EU standards on platform work, but we should also be creating this new generation of rights for all workers who are subject to these technologies, rather than just those who happen to be working through platforms. And then the second point you raised about how do we make sure, you know, responsibility is passed up. I think there has to be legal incentives to make sure that the developers can't just design a discriminatory technology, sell it to employers, and then wash their hands of it. So a system of joint liability that goes up the value chain, impact assessments and audits at that development stage, as well as the implementation stage by employers, those kinds of things will be really important in making sure that there's no gaps in our protections.
I think in the publication we mentioned the idea of a licensing system as well, which might be another tool in the armory for that. Theoretically, I guess they could lose the license to either sell the product or operate the product in the UK. It's just potential idea, isn't it, for regulating it? Okay, I'm aware that time's ticking on, so I wondered if we wanted to say anything about the socioeconomic duty. Now, that's something that's been on the statute books for a while, since the Equality Act 2010, but it's not been formally enacted. And I had a look We've got friends in the Equality Trust who've done quite a bit of work on this, and it says, a little excerpt from their website, the socio and economic duty requires public bodies to adopt transparent and effective measures to address the inequalities that result from differences in occupation, education, place of residence or social class. The successive governments have refused to enact this law, but now it looks like it might finally be enacted. So what does this mean for workers and communities in the UK when indeed it is enacted?
So the provision, which is in Section 1 of the Equality Act 2010, was never brought into effect by the coalition government. But what it requires is that when making decisions of a strategic nature about how to exercise functions, an authority must have due regard to the desirability of exercising its functions in a way that is designed to reduce the inequalities of outcome which result from socioeconomic disadvantage. So if you look at that, this is really potentially quite a radical provision. It actually requires government to have regard to the impact of its decisions on socioeconomic disadvantage, and that's potentially why it was never brought into effect. However, if you look at it harder, it's actually a very light touch provision. It is a requirement to have due regard to the desirability of exercising your functions in a way which is designed to reduce inequalities. And it only applies to decisions of a strategic nature. Nevertheless, since 2000, we've had various public sector equality duties, which are also based on this duty to have due regard to, in that case, the need to either eliminate unlawful discrimination, promote equality of opportunity, or facilitate good relations. And many of us who've worked in public sector organisations have seen the operation of the public sector equality duty, which can very easily just become a tick box exercise. So you start off your meeting, you're in a committee, and the first agenda item is, we are having due regard to our public sector equality duty, and everyone nods and carries on. So if this provision on socioeconomic inequalities is really going to have effect, it needs to be bolstered by some much more specific duties, which there used to be before the 2010 Act, specific duties on the authorities to whom it applies about the kind of things that they need to have due regard to and what socioeconomic inequality means, what kind of decisions there are. And to that, we could look at the Fairer Scotland duty, because the Scottish authority has power to bring in something very similar, and it did a few years ago. And what's really interesting is that they've put a lot of trouble into defining what socioeconomic disadvantage means, not just income, but where you live, what access you have to wealth, what is the healthcare in your location. And then again, what are the inequalities of outcome which matter, such as, again, health outcomes, crime, and other aspects of community life. So we've already got this really good potential model to build on. It's still too early to say how impactful the Fairer Scotland duty has been, but I think with goodwill from public bodies, it could make a difference. And I think there is a very important role for participation by those who are affected, including workers, including trade unions, because one of the big problems with the public sector equality duty is it's been very top-down. Initially, in the early years, the idea is that it would be participative. Particularly the disability movement were very keen to say nothing about us without us. So the involvement part of that public duty, when it applied only to disability, was a key part. And I think for this duty to really have proper traction, we need to be sure that the unions feel it's part of what they do, that workers feel it's part of what they do, and that it's not just seen as a top-down tick-box exercise.
All interesting stuff. So, well, unfortunately, I think that's all we've got time for in this episode, folks. Thanks to our speakers, Professor Sandy Fredman and Dr. Joe Atkinson, for sharing their knowledge and experience with us and their valuable time out of their days. Please do go and read our book on algorithmic management that we discussed before. It talks about those issues a lot more detail than we were able to manage in this episode. And thanks again to Thompson Solicitors for their kind support in doing this podcast. And thanks again to you, the listeners, for being part of our new podcast and being part of the debate.
This podcast is sponsored by Thompson Solicitors and it's produced for the Institute of Employment Rights by Creative Kin. To find out more, visit creativekin.co.uk/IER.